Okay, we're going to talk about the sport of politics now. What a great sport that is. Okay. And we want to welcome back to our show local state Senator Wayne Langerholt. Senator, welcome back.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thanks for
coming. It's a long walk from your office, which is like 20 steps over there, all right, in the same building. So we,
location, location, location.
Yeah, we planned that perfectly. I mean, I've got a whole boatload of questions here for you of all different, different stripes, but let me just start with kind of an open-ended, like a general question. What have you been, you know, sort of handling lately, top issues that are on the top of your list? As far as state stuff is concerned, let's start just with a general question. How's it been going?
Sure. It's been going good. Thanks for having me again. It's been a busy season so far. We're getting ready to roll in here now to the budget, which is probably the biggest thing that we deal with in the state legislature. We'll be there pretty much the whole month of June. The fiscal year is at July 1st, so we're trying to get a responsible budget crafted here. So that's kind of the main issue that we're focused on. But in addition to that, some other things that I've been dealing with, the two proposed prison closures, Rockview and Quihana, also in Clearfield County, the news of Penn State Dubois, which, depending on how you view there, the leak that was given to the Inquirer and things of that nature, and also the Clearfield Lock Haven campus proposed close. So it's Clearfield County's been hit pretty hard over the past couple months, so we're dealing with issues related to that.
All right, well, you just hit several things I had on my list, so how about that? Let me start with this one. We just had a caller in our last segment. Yesterday was primary election day, and the caller said, I'm an independent, and so he couldn't vote yesterday for anything, I guess. And we've had a guest on before about this push for independents being able to vote in the primary election here in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a closed primary. They can't do that. What do you think on that? Should that be allowed? I mean, the majority of states out there have so-called open primaries. We don't, for whatever the reasons are. Let me toss it to you. I mean, yay, nay, what are the reasons? What do you think about that?
It's an interesting issue. It's an issue that kind of cuts down the middle as far as within the district where it's at exactly. I'm always cognizant there's a two-party system, and yes, that they may not be able to vote in the primary, but they could vote if they would, you know, sign up with a specific party. And I think that you have to be careful if you're, you know, permitting independents to vote that aren't a part of that party. And there's a two-party system. We want our candidates to be elected by those people that are in the party. So it's an issue that has, I don't want to say gained a lot of traction, but it's out there. It's been discussed. It hasn't been really discussed at length. Obviously, I'm open to, you know, hearing the pros and cons from either side, but it's not something that's really been on the radar, you know, at the forefront with something that we're dealing with in the legislature.
Could we just I don't want to disenfranchise anybody, but I don't want non-Republicans voting for the Republican candidate or non-Democrats voting for the Democratic candidate. Could we have an independent and, you know, maybe throw in other third parties that, hey, you can come and vote and just have a separate tally? And if I don't know how often it would happen, but if, you know, candidate X wins the Republican and candidate Y wins the Democratic nominations, and then somebody that was second on one of those ballots or even third or, you know, wherever, is the choice of independents, then add a third candidate as this was the choice of independents or whatever. I feel like at the end of the day, we're going to end up with the same candidates regardless. And I say, I'm okay with them voting. I just don't want them voting for the candidates that, you know, I'm a Republican. I don't want independents choosing the candidate for my party. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it's an issue that you've got to be very careful with, especially in light of the recent headlines and the recent news and just the general, I think, concern that a lot of people have in our election system. You know, some of the things that have happened over the year, I think that there is definitely, going to be a lot of pause with respect to the appetite that you have to dealing with elections again. You see what happened whenever that was passed not too long ago, and then the Supreme Court's interpretation of things that weren't even in the law that we passed. You know, I'm talking specifically about drop boxes. There was nowhere in that legislation or that act that allowed for drop boxes, and it was pure judicial interpretation to allow that. So very hesitant to open it up for other election opportunities. It's something that we could talk about, something that could be put in, absolutely. But, again, it's very I don't think the timing is right for that, and I have concern with opening that up again.
Is that something that Harrisburg decides, or individual parties decide if independents can vote? How does that work, or how would that work?
That could be put into the bill. That could be put in the bill. It would be ultimately signed into the law to kind of craft that how you wanted it to be.
All right, Penn State campuses. Now, I don't have a map in front of me. So your zone, your district that you cover, okay? Like, for instance, you cover part of Center County. Then you cover other counties, all right? And you mentioned a few minutes ago, you mentioned Penn State Dubois. Now, is that in your zone?
Yes. So I represent all of Cambria County, all of Clearfield County, and the western part of Center County. I don't have the university. I have everything west of State College Borough. So Penn State Dubois is in. Originally, when I was first elected in 2016, I had Bedford County, Cambria, and Clearfield, but not Dubois. So with the redistricting, I got Dubois. And actually, if you look at it numbers-wise, I could have just taken Dubois and had Clearfield, Cambria, and Bedford, and that would have fulfilled with the census. But the problem was there was such a loss of population in the western part of the state that the other senators had to move kind of east, and geographically, if you look at a map, Bedford, Cambridge, I'm kind of blocking everybody. So that was Bedford County, then went to my colleague, Senator Pat Stefano, and then I got this portion of western part of Center County.
Okay. So you've got one campus. You've got the Dubois campus, all right? So this does kind of affect you. We got this big online stuff happening tomorrow. Board of Trustees is going to meet. President Ben DePuy is going to give an address online or something. What are your thoughts on this? Because Penn State Dubois is on the hit list. What do you think?
It's a big concern for me. That is a integral part of the Dubois area of Greater Clearfield County, and especially in light of decisions for the close of Clearfield Lock Haven campus, that leaves my constituents, the residents of Clearfield County, without institutions of higher ed. Now, I say that also with the caveat that the numbers are down drastically across the state, and that's not just for branch campuses. It's talking about higher education in general. And you saw that recently with the newer chancellor of the state system recognizing that, and you saw those different mergers of the state systems into kind of different geographic hubs to address that issue. But the bottom line is there are not more students, and it's only projected to decrease. So there needs to be obviously the hard conversations going forward, but also you need to recognize what that does to for the greater Dubois region, and specifically some of the programs that they're working on, they have to help with the powder metal industry up there in that area, and also in the northwest part. They fill that need. So that's a concern, is where are those students going to go, and how is that going to be addressed? Will there still be some type of a footprint, so to speak, with Penn State Dubois, recognizing the need that they do fill on that? And then if that decision is made, how do we deal with that prospectively?
All right. Now, Penn State is a state-related university, not state-owned. That's, Lock Haven, Bloomsburg, so on. State-related. Does that mean that whenever this gets official, which I guess won't be tomorrow, whatever they're going to do online tomorrow, might be next week, next month, whatever, state-related, does the state somehow get involved with this? In state government somehow, like, wait a minute, Penn State, you can't do that, or something like that? Or does the state really have no involvement, even though they're a state-related university?
There is some oversight with the Department of Education. The Secretary of Ed has to sign off on this. Now, that can lead to, and I'm certain, well, I mean, not certain, but that may lead to some type of legal challenge. The code is pretty clear that the secretary has to sign off after that is presented to her. Right now it's acting secretary Carrie Rowe, who's up for confirmation here within the Senate. But what that means, can she stop that? I think it's more of a formality. There's a certain procedure and process that the universities have to follow and then present to the Department of Ed. And I think if those things are met, the boxes are checked, so to speak, then she ultimately, I don't think, has much discretion in that. But again, that's open interpretation.
So what do you think is going to happen here?
I'm an optimistic person. I am hopeful that there is still some footprint for Penn State Du Bois, but obviously I'm opposed to the closure of Penn State Du Bois.
What does that mean, footprint? I don't understand. What is that? What are you thinking about?
Still some type of involvement for certain programs. You know, I don't know what the end game is. I don't know if it is going to be a complete exit? Is it going to be a partial exit? Is it going to be, you know, are they going to stay in operation? So,
all right. All right. Now, you mentioned Rockview Prison and Quihana Boot Camp. Now, Senator Chris Dush just joined us, was that 2 weeks ago? I think it was. And he's fired up over this one, all right, for a number of things. And he's issued releases and he's taking actions. Now, granted, he has a leadership position in Harrisburg on the government committee or whatever that is. What are your thoughts? I mean, have you done anything when it comes to Rockview, Quihana? What's been your response here?
Yes, I have pretty openly opposed that and been involved from the initial announcement. And there's a lot of things. The way this transpired was, you know, not exactly transparent. And I can tell you that I was in a meeting. I was on a Monday before the announcement, and I got a call from one of the governor's action team indicating that that was the plan, that they were going to close that. Now, the only issue that I have with that is that I got the call about an hour or two after the news media had reported on it. So I would have appreciated some heads up, you know, even that we're looking at this, but I didn't get that. And since that, I've taken a lot of steps to be up there. Look, I've been at Quihana. I've spoken at their graduation ceremony a couple of times. I've toured that facility. I've been there. I see the great work that they do in that facility. And I think it is absolutely nonsensical to propose a closure for a facility that we know is working. There's this big push in Harrisburg in light of some recent trends through justice reinvestment and different types of laws that were passed to help with inmates and with, you know, recidivism. And this should be the model for what a state correctional institution is. We know that the recidivism rates for Quihana are the lowest in the state. We know that Quihana, which is a smaller state institution, produces more GEDs than any other state institution. It actually produced, I think last year, upwards of 21-22% of all GEDs. We know that inmates coming out of Quihana are getting vocational certificates that are then enabling them to go out into the workforce. And more than that, I invite anyone listening to this that is involved in the lobbying process, I've invited the governor, come and see what they're doing at the Quihana Boot Camp. It is unlike anything you will see. The level of respect that the staff get, it is a military-type facility. I mean, they're there. It's not an easy program. They're up at the crack of dawn. They're doing PT, they're in the classroom, and it is working, and it is producing inmates. There were, at the public hearing with the Department of Corrections, there was a former inmate that came. And I received, you know, countless emails and things on Facebook saying, look, I was an inmate. This saved my life. I am now working here. I have my own business. I'm a productive member of society. Why do we want to shut the door on that success? It makes absolutely no sense, and I will fight it every way I can. If you allow me a little more to talk about that, I've actually introduced some legislation to address that. So One thing that happened, the numbers for boot camp have dropped. Now, that can be attributed to the rise in the new program, the state drug treatment program. So what that is, and they're both in that facility. So that is a flat 2-year sentence for state drug treatment program to allow individuals dealing with addiction to go through that program. And within 2 years, then they're done with the program. It's not all incarceration. There's like a little bit of a breakdown of, you know, some time within the institution, but then also some time in some outside facilities to help with the drug treatment. But what we were seeing was people were more apt to go into that program. Number one, it's a little bit easier. You're not up the crack of dawn. You're not doing that PT. You're not part of that boot camp facility. But also, when they're done with that program, they're done. And it would even, you know, forgive the balance of that sentence. Boot camp is not that way. So you go through that program, and then you still have the tail. So I'll put on my old prosecutor hat here. You know, if you're sentenced to, say, a term of incarceration of 2 to 5 years, 2 to 6 years, you know, anything over a 2-year sentence, you're incarcerated in a state facility. The balance of that, you would still have to be on probation and be subject to supervision. It's not that way with state drug treatment. So the plan that I have is to modernize the boot camp to make it more of an incentive, because we want to get more people into that type of a program, and we need to tweak it a little bit to allow them the same kind of opportunities for the state drug treatment program so that they're coming out. Because the goal is we want productive members of society. We know boot camp's doing that, so we need to kind of rethink it, and it hasn't been looked at for many, many years. So that's my goal, is to help change that, bring the numbers back up with at the boot camp, and save the facility.
Yeah, I giving people a sense of purpose, which is what that boot camp clearly does, I just think is we want to get people back as productive members of society, and the track record there speaks for itself. I think you were very kind in saying that they were not transparent. I think it went a step beyond not transparent with the Rock View, because I'm reading the initial story and I'm like, well, my gosh, if there's all these repairs and it's going to cost all of these millions of dollars, maybe this makes some sense. And then we have Senator Dushan, and he's like, no, those repairs have already been done. That isn't not being transparent. That is flat out, bald faced lying to the public and to everybody about what is actually happening and what the actual state is. That is outrageous, isn't a strong enough term, but it is certainly outrageous at the very least.
Yeah, I agree. And there's so many more things at play here when you're talking about saving dollars. So the total operational budget for that facility, I think, is $34 million, of which $29 million is in salaries. So if you're coming out saying, we're going to guarantee every one of these employees is going to have a job, well, you're going to save $5 million. And then on top of that, at Quihana, there's also a wastewater treatment plant that services another business. There's actually a business. So what happens with that? And then when you're talking about mothballing costs, because you're going to have to keep that operational, you know, what those costs are, at the end of the day, the amount that you're saving is minimal. And it is a sore spot with me when you have that announcement coming out a couple weeks after the governor's budget address calling for a massive increase in spending. And on top of that, the governor has no problem just unilaterally taking dollars from our transportation projects in the other part of the state to give $260-some million to SEPTA with the stroke of a pen. So those are the things that keep me up at night and give me pause that this is not a cost-saving measure. You're exactly right. You know, I'm not even certain that the actual parts in that report were accurate. And that facility at Quihana just had an extension put on not too long ago. So there's stuff that really isn't going to be saved going forward.
All right, before we take a break, at one point it appeared the hammer was going to drop right around now about these two facilities. What's going to happen now? Or what's happening now?
They are still in the process of reviewing all of the testimony at the different public hearings that they had. They had two of them, one at Quihana, one at Rockview. And I can tell you that I have been actively involved in one form or another from the beginning, meeting with everyone and advocating on behalf of those facilities and just trying to get them to realize the importance of them.
Now, if the Department of Corrections keeps pushing, and they're like, yep, we're doing this, is there still a way to stop things, slow things? What happens after the DOC says, yep, we're doing it anyway? What happens then?
That can become part of even the negotiations that we have here going forward with this budget. So there's a couple different avenues that we're exploring to ensure that these facilities stay operational.
So this is a long way from over.
Let's hope.
Okay, all right. State Senator Wayne Langerholt is our guest. We're going to take a break. We've got some more questions for the senator of various kinds. You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox. Don't go anywhere. We'll come right back after this.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7
The Fox.
The 36th annual historic Bellefonte Cruise is Friday, June 13th and Saturday, June 14th in downtown Bellefonte, Central Pennsylvania's largest car show. Get all the details on the fun, food, activities, and live entertainment. Visit BellefonteCruise.org or call 814-280-5881. Sponsors include Center Communications, Inc., Five Star Chrysler, Rick Snyder's Concessions, PAMP, Premier Garage, and Clearwater Pool.
Let Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox make you a winner this summer with our Summer Splash Contest with Clearwater Pools and Spas in Center Hall. This Father's Day weekend, The Fox will be giving away a spacious hot springs hot tub during a Bellefonte cruise at Talleyrand Park in downtown Bellefonte. Stop by these fine locations and get signed up to become a qualifier for the contest. Dottery Equipment, Route 64 in Mill Hall. Fisher's Market at the Y in Milesburg. And at Clearwater Pools and Spas in Center Hall.
The State College Spikes 2025 season is just around the corner. The 40-game regular season home slate runs Friday, June 6th through August 28th and features three great bobbleheads honoring Paul Posluszny, Katie Schumacher Colley, and Guy Gadowski. Three Bark in the Park nights, ELGSES night on August 23rd. Enjoy fun, affordable family entertainment here in Happy Valley. For tickets, call 814-272-1711 and buy and download at statecollegespikes.com.
If you're like me, you have neighbors that have zero-turn mowers, and some are satisfied and others not so much. I've had neighbors come over while I'm mowing with my Kubota and want to try it out. I told Bob and Clyde, you need to get to Dotter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64, for Kubota. I have a Z200 25 horsepower with the simplest operation and a pristine cut every time. Even though I have a lawn and, shall we say, a challenging bank, ditch, and of course the wife's ornamental bushes. If you're trying to decide on a great lawn care machine, get to Dotter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. At Dotter Equipment, they're experts on Kubota lawn care machines that keep you moving quickly and efficiently. Your destination for Kubota is Dotter Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. You may even meet my neighbors, Bob and Clyde.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox.
It is our Wednesday edition of Let's Talk here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox. Again, Pirates baseball rolling your way this afternoon at 12:10, the airtime, as they wrap up that series with the Reds. And again, we'll have a special program for you with Landon Tengwall behind the wall tonight at 7 o'clock, following Jim Galati's Keystone Kickoff Show, which will run from 6 to 7 in its entirety tonight, and then Landon with an interview with Guy Gadowski, head coach of the Penn State hockey program. That will run from 7 to 7:30 this evening. A little open phone time coming up in the final segment of this morning's show.
Again, we're joined by State Senator Wayne Langerholt for another segment this morning. Fun things in Washington, or not so fun things in Washington, and how it affects Pennsylvania. Senator, let me start with this one, right? Medicaid. Now, Medicaid gets tossed back to states. Allegedly, people in D.C. want to cut money to Medicaid, although President Trump apparently told Republicans down in Washington yesterday, don't mess with Medicaid. I assume you folks are discussing this in Harrisburg, like possible Medicaid changes and how it would affect things here. What are your views on that?
It's something that is very concerning, obviously, any kind of loss and potential funding, and that's something I hear about quite frequently. And on the state-related side of it as well, that's something that we're grappling with, the increased costs and the cost drivers with the budget with that. And actually, one of the bigger drivers of that being the popularity of some of these weight loss drugs, which has really, really, really driven up that cost.
Yep.
So something that is going to be a top part of the budget negotiations as we go forward here in June.
So if they do this, let's do a what if, all right? D.C. covers Medicaid amounts and it goes back to the states. Is that just cuts, or does the state have to somehow make up the difference? How would that work?
Yeah, it would be
exactly
something that we would have to look at in making up that difference.
So the state would make up the difference, not just pass along cuts?
Well, that would be part of the conversation of how do we address that, really.
Okay. Now, do you I don't know, confer or communicate with, like, Glenn Thompson or John Fetterman or Dave McCormick? Or do you, like, talk about these various things?
We do, to a certain extent. I have a good working relationship with our individuals within D.C.
All right. Now, SNAP, which I still call food stamps, all right, the SNAP program for folks that need extra help with food and so on. Allegedly, there's supposed to be cuts to that. Now, I guess Harrisburg gets involved with that as well, the SNAP program?
Yeah, to the same extent with the overall broad discussion on Medicaid.
So if they cut, again, the idea is Harrisburg supposed to make up the difference somehow?
And it depends who you talk to within Harrisburg, I guess. But obviously, where does that ultimately land? But yes, if there's a massive deficit that's going to be passed on from Washington, that's going to have to be dealt with. You know, we're the next line in that discussion.
All right. Now, you had an earlier comment about big money to SEPTA. And I could tell by the look on your face you're not a big fan. Okay, SEPTA, if you're not familiar, is the kind of mass transit for the greater Philadelphia area, Philadelphia and the suburban counties and so on, trains, buses, all that sort of thing. And I read some story that hey, if those folks out in the rest of Pennsylvania would just pay more money, SEPTA would be great. I mean, is that what you're thinking, this idea? And Shapiro, I guess, is big on this. An increase for SEPTA, the money's going to come from us and go to them. Is that, or am I being simplistic there?
My issue with it is that there are a host of transit agencies throughout the Commonwealth that are dealing with the same issue. And there's no shortage of people that knock on my door in Harrisburg that, it's always the same. They need more money, and we understand that. But there also needs to be some accountability with respect to the delivery model that you have, and particularly with SEPTA. And back when I was chair of the Transportation Committee, that was obviously something that we dealt with. That was the last budget cycle that there was this call for this mass increase in mass transit. And we had held several hearings to address that. And our position in the Republican caucus was, we're not just going to fund mass transit without also taking a look at roads and bridges and critical infrastructure within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And that was our goal and our hope, to get a broad transportation package done to address all of that. Unfortunately, we were unable to meet with consensus on that issue. We reached a kind of a maybe a stopgap provision last budget cycle where we allocated, I think it was 81 million for both, 80 million for mass transit, 80 million for roads and bridges, and then with the goal of trying to address that overall. And then within, I don't know how many months from that, the governor pulled another 200 and some million to give to SEPTA, and he took it out of his discretion that he has within some of the projects. Problem was, he took it from roads and bridges projects in the western part of the state or the central part of the state and then gave it to SEPTA. So my speaking to SEPTA at those hearings was, re-examine your delivery model. Look, we know that your ridership is down. We know that as a result, it was down during COVID, and then it was down after COVID. And part of that is due to the fact that there are a lot of people that aren't riding transit to go to work. A lot of people are working remotely. You see that, you know, anytime you look at a job employment posting, hybrid, remote work. Yeah. So that was a loss. Another component of that was safety. And I've taken steps and actually had a bill signed into law to appoint a special prosecutor to address that safety component on SEPTA. So those kind of things that came together, and then an unwillingness, because they told us that they were looking at that, looking at other models and how to change routes, et cetera, to kind of save money on that end, but yet they've failed to implement that. And then conversely, you have other transit agencies here in State College, you have them in the western part of the state that are doing that. They're re-examining their delivery models, going from these fixed bus rates to micro transit or vans to address that issue. So I don't understand why SEPTA just expects a government bailout year after year, that we're just going to say, oh, we need this money, and you're just going to be give it to us. So until there's some kind of a movement there to re-examine what their delivery model is, I will not be optimistic on that front. And that's a big, big cost driver.
All right. You mentioned the state budget earlier. Fun times. You actually going to hit July 1st or June 30th?
As I said, I'm an optimistic person, so that's the goal.
He's smiling when he says that. Okay. When's the last time, I honestly don't know, when's the last time that the June 30 deadline got met for the budget?
Well, that's a good question. It's been some time, for sure.
Okay, long time. All right.
Which, by the way, is state law that be met. Just in case anybody's interested.
So does that mean you're going to jail if you don't do it by July 1st, Senator? Or? No, okay. Let's move on. A lot more money than in the past. Or at least the governor wants this, that, and the other thing, some things that we've talked about. I mean, what are the key items in this year's budget where there's been a lot of infighting or arguing and so on?
That's one of them, is mass transit. Another one is education funding. You know, that's a constant conversation, that there's not enough money that's given to schools and to education. But my opinion on this is that we spend money and have gotten far afield from core governmental services. We pay our taxes, and I've said this a million times before, when you pay your taxes, you want core government services. You want good roads to drive on, you want police protection, you want fire protection, you want a good school to send your kids to, you want EMS, firefighting. And it's gotten so far afield from that. And I have real concern when I meet with, specifically on the EMS front, EMS firefighting front, these EMS ambulance associations closing down, and people are just expecting that they're going to pick up a call and somebody's going to be there. And it is getting past the point of no return here with this loss in vital services. That's what we need to be spending our money on. That's what the people depend on, and that's what taxpayer dollars should be used for. So that's a part of the conversation that we're having and what needs to be addressed, in my opinion.
So what are we spending money on that's far afield?
Well, there's two. So when I speak to schools, I always ask them, I say, you know, how much money do you think that the state of Pennsylvania spends? You know, and depending on the age that you get with the different children, some people are like $100,000, $150,000, blah, 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 or, you know, $2 billion. And I always ask, okay, $2 billion? Like, yeah, $2 billion. So I'm like, who thinks it's more than $2 billion? And very few raise their hand. And when they'll be surprised that it was last year was $45 billion. And I say, you could go back in time to January the 1st of 1900 and spend $1 million every day from that day to today, and it still wouldn't amount to that. And that kind of puts it in perspective for that. But of that $45 billion, almost half of it is education. The other half is human services. So those are the two big cost drivers within the budget. Now, I understand there are 500 school districts here in Pennsylvania, and that is a core service that we need to spend on. But also, I think we need to look at, we are not increasing population in that front, and that definitely needs to be addressed.
Yeah, there's just so many... So many different components. Let me just ask you, though, is the uncertainty right now in Washington adding to the difficulty in figuring out the state budget? Because I think there are some things where, at least previously, it's like, all right, well, we know this amount is coming in. And maybe it still is, but maybe it isn't. Until you get... more certainty in the direction on some of these items, is that adding to the difficulty of coming up with the state budget, or do you pretty well know in terms of the relationship between federal funding, state funding, that it's just a separate issue?
I would say it's somewhat, not entirely a tremendous amount. That's the some of the concerns that I have with that, and understanding that we need to be fiscal stewards of the tax dollar, period. Like, that's the biggest job that I have, that the constituents of the 35th District sent me to Harrisburg to make sure that those are spent adequately. Concern that I have is some of the federal dollars that are potentially in play here to being lost. And I'll cite one example, specific example, and I'm not saying that this is on the cutting block or on the chopping block, but within like the Johnstown area, there was so many mine discharge of that acid mine water into the stream, so much so that when I was a kid driving downtown Johnstown, it's bright orange rivers. If you would have told me someday that I would catch fish in that river, I'd say you're crazy. But there, you know, those dollars, that's a big component to clean up those streams, which then leads to more economic activity, more recreational opportunities for, you know, residents of that county. And that's statewide. So those are things that I understand that you need to cut where you can cut, but you can't just blanketly cut across the board and then leave vital services, you know, in the lurch here.
What about raising more revenue? God forbid, without taxes. Is there some discussion? Hey, let's find... And marijuana. Okay, here we go. Raising more revenue. What are there ideas floating around down there?
There are. There are two. That you hit one of them there. That's a proposal of the governor to raise money through the legal sale of adult-use cannabis. I'm very hesitant and opposed to that. I don't think that is the panacea that you think that it is, because on the back end, I think you're just shifting one pocket to another, and you're going to have a much more higher cost of increased services in dealing with that. So that's not something that I support. The other big, I guess, low-hanging fruit that you would call would be the regulation of the skill games. That has been a proliferation. You see those. I'm sure your listeners can think of different things that have popped up over the years just in the middle of nowhere. And that's something that we need to examine, and that could be a tremendous source of revenue. And I say that too with the caveat that we need to understand that there are a couple of different types of those skill games. So there's the ones that are in your, you know, your American Legions, your VFWs, your small bars and taverns that have kept them afloat during COVID and are a vital piece of that. So that is something that is much needed with the revenue. Now, there's a big difference in my eyes, between going into a VFW where that money stays local and is there versus you see a skill game parlor, which is almost like a mini casino at a strip mall, where it's an outside state-owned business venture where they come in, take that money, and it goes right out of the state. So that's the balancing act that we have that we're faced with, and I'm hopeful that something that can be addressed, and there's potential for significant revenue in that front, but it's got to be done the right way. So we need to make sure that we're taking care of our American Legions or VFWs or local bars and taverns versus just, I think there's one on 22. If I drive to Pittsburgh, it's just like an old garage, and it's a skill game. I mean, who owns that? I mean, that's not local money. That's just going out. So that needs to be something that needs to be regulated on the tax end, as well as who's checking to see if these kids are even of age to be playing these facilities.
All right. I've got one more question. Now, this is slightly selfish. All right. I'm looking at a story here from the Penn Capital Star, which is a statewide media outlet. Lawmakers hear testimony on meeting Pennsylvania power demand. Now, we had a situation a few weeks ago with our continuing adventures in radio where we had no power here for 3 days because some crazy storm hit over there on West College Avenue and knocked all the poles and lines and stuff down. And we were grounded for 3 days. And I know there's an increasing power demand across the state, not just in certain places. I mean, has this come up in any discussions you've done about what to do about power and energy, make it better and make it bigger, that we need more of it? What's being talked about?
All the time. And this is something that the governor could rectify rather simply. And this goes back to Reggie, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and his insistence on putting Pennsylvania into that, which has stymied development in the Commonwealth. We sit on a massive store of natural gas, and we have pretty much hampered that development. There is some movement here in different areas, but with the war on coal and then this reluctance to not put us in Reggie. I mean, we've seen it. There has been lost development opportunities that could lead to energy, to power, and it's only going to get worse. When you see different companies that are coming into our Commonwealth, actually, that are talking about proposed data centers. I think there's one in Harrisburg that are going to use Three Mile Island. I think it's Microsoft, and they're going to use that. But the power that they generate through that reactor is just going to go to Microsoft. I don't know how much of that's going to go back on the grid. But, I mean, we're fortunate now that we're in spring, summer here, that we don't have the issues with heat or those rolls, but actually it's probably going to, with the rise in air conditioning, it's not going to get any better. But it always perplexed me the reluctance to capitalize on the tremendous natural resources that we have here in the Commonwealth, specifically with natural gas, and it doesn't have to happen.
If I recall real quick that story, they're going to restart TMI. All the power, all of it, is going to go to this Microsoft data center, which, if I recall, is out of state. I don't even think it's in Pennsylvania. So that just seemed a little strange.
A lot of strange things happen in Harrisburg, for sure. That is the biggest gripe that I have with this current administration, is their unwillingness to embrace the energy resources we have. We could be a leader within the nation on that front, and there's no reason why we should have. We could drive down the cost of energy, and it's here. It's abundant, and there are ways to take advantage of that.
Well, Senator, we appreciate your time this morning. As always, thank you very much. We'll let you take 20 steps to go back to your local office right over here in the same building. And hopefully we can have you on again. Thank you.
I appreciate it, guys. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for the time.
All right.